Okay, folks, this week's Chabur is sponsored by and learning in Shul the entire week is sponsored by Rachel and Josh Iskowitz and family in honor of the Bas Mitzvah of Chabanessa Iskowitz. And as is chus for Refuah Shleima for Zelda Rivka Bas Bluma, she should have Refuah Shleima, and she should continue to enjoy Arichas Yamim Bishanim Tovim Meitov Tam Vadas. So before we get started with tonight's topic, which I call lovingly Shilas about crowding my space, we'll see what that means in a minute. But before we get into the technicalities of tonight's questions, I have to say that I'm not so used to getting as many opinionated responses to just the advertisement, just that people who looked at the questions. You can see that a lot of people have a lot of opinions, but you know they already decided their answers. We'll see whether we agree with them or whether we don't agree with them. We'll look at three questions or three generalized questions, and I want to hear what you have to say. We'll choose which ones we go through and which ones we'll save for Trashing the Lines, which I think is we're expecting a Trashing the Lines one coming up soon. There are a whole lot of questions we haven't dealt with since the beginning of Chumash Bereishis. Well, let's start with tonight's three. Tonight I'm only down to three questions, because I think if any one of these three could probably be a full shiur in of itself. Our shul has a strong no smoking on the premises policy. There are people who do smoke, and others who, due to the discomfort or due to physical illness, cannot handle the smell. So can a public space like a shul or a beis medrash insist on a non-smoking policy? And must it be adhered to? And what if most of the people in the shul don't care, or the yeshiva? And what if someone doesn't exactly smoke on the premises, but because he smokes off the premises, his clothing reeks of smoke, and I don't like that. It offends me. Can I ask that person to leave? That's question number one. Question number two, very timely, although it wasn't at the beginning of the week, it became much more timely. The news is abuzz about the recent outbreak of measles in the Frum community. I'm driving to shul this morning, and obviously everything was ready this morning, but I'm driving to shul this morning, and on the news, on the way in, they outlined the terrible outbreak. It's all over the tri-state area. Rockland County, Ocean County, and Brooklyn. What's common in those three areas? There's also three areas where you cannot make returns to certain stores, right? If you buy things online. But we'll save that for another time. Right? So the news is abuzz with the recent outbreak of measles in the Frum community. In fact, I heard that new takanas were enacted in Vishnes Benos Yaakov and in other yeshivos as a result. Last week, I saw a number of signs in different shuls that declared that those who are not up to date on vaccinations may not enter the building. Can a shul do that? And what if the person davening there follows a different psak that holds that vaccinations are a sakana? That's question number two. And question number three for the night, because it's good to do things in threes. My child attends a school with a serious approach to bullying. It got me thinking, can a school expel a child for bullying because he or she is preventing others from learning? What if the offending person is not a bully but a drug dealer? If he's crowding my child's learning experience, does it make a difference or not? And those will be the three topics for tonight. So we got the bullying question and the expulsion for the child who's crowding the space. We have the vaccine question in the shul for the individual who argues that it's crowding the space, but maybe following a different psak. And then we have the smoker whose smell is crowding the space. And which of the three should we go with first? Any other opinions? If not, we'll start with the smoke. You want? Okay, so I have to try to fit them both in. All right, since Yossi spoke up first, Yossi gets to win first. Yossi, so what's the deal? Can you enact an anti-smoking on the premises policy?
Sure.
Yes. Why? So obviously it goes without saying, if you're in New York City where smoking is banned in public premises, If a shul were to be determined to be a public location, which it isn't, right, you would be correct. But the application of Dina, one second, but the application of Dina de Malchusa Dina over in that situation wouldn't apply in our situation, because the public, the Dina de Malchusa Dina over here, we assume that our shuls are private residences, not as far as the Dina de Malchus is concerned.
I meant more as if the Melch can make their own decisions, then a private entity can make their own decision too.
So what does that mean? Right? I didn't follow that.
Meaning that if there's a precedent where public spaces are deemed to say there's no smoking in this area, then you can apply that also in a shul.
Why?
Even though a shul...
I think that's a pretty wide stretch using Dina Malchus Adina.
Shul, based on the tax code or whatever, may be considered a private entity. From a community aspect, it's a public entity because anyone can walk in and walk out.
Anyone can walk in and out of my house too. Some people do.
I'm going to go with B'chai Bahem.
B'chai Bahem?
So
what do you do with all the sources that say smoking's a good thing?
There's
I think that's changed over
the
years.
That's a serious question, but if you consider it a monetary loss to the shul, if you smoke in a hotel room, you get fined because they have to wash down the walls and they have to do everything to make the room.
You guys are all swimming around a certain concept that may be important. You're swimming around it. Now let's try to go after it.
Hectish?
No, just the opposite. You were just arguing something different, right?
We discussed a few weeks ago. It's for the people.
Right.
People
so how would we look at a shul? Is a shul Rishus HaRabim? No. A shul does not have a status of Rishus HaRabim. But a shul does have a status of Shechinim, right? We have a concept called Neskei Shechinim, right? Let's take a step back for a second. We have a concept called Nezek. First of all, let me take a further step back. I think we can all agree, Lesman de Polig, that today smoking is usher. How usher is smoking, that'll depend on how badly you're addicted, right? But one thing is pretty clear, that smoking causes a problem, and I think al pi halacha, certainly a person doesn't have a right to start smoking. And it's funny, Sunday night, I spent the whole day in training on Sunday. Sunday night there was a program in Teaneck to talk about drugs. It was a very important program, and there were a lot of wonderful things that were said. So at the end of the program, one of the questions that wasn't reached, but they wanted to point out that it wasn't, was, can a person be held responsible for being addicted to drugs if, after all, there's a suspension of Bechira? So I was talking to the rabbi on the panel. His name is Rabbi Larry Rothwex. He's a wonderful rabbi in Beth Aaron. So he said he didn't understand the question, because I had whispered this in the back to my brother-in-law who I was sitting next to, but also in the front. Rabbi Rothwex said the same thing. He didn't understand. And just because a person may, even if you want to argue that an addiction suspends somebody's bechira, that doesn't mean that you were addicted before you started. So it's a question of whether when you started, is this just a continuation of that one ma'isa avera, or is it each and every time, etc.? That could be a basis of a discussion, but to say that there's no bechira for an addict, that's a little bit off the wall, and a person doesn't have the ability and the option to be able to make that discussion. So the first thing that I think we have to go with is that smoking is asr, right? Certainly starting to smoke, I think, is 100% asr. So once that, and that's not what I want to spend the night on, because that was not the question. But just so you know, that in 2006, the RCA's Vat Halacha put out a very nice long paper on why smoking is usher, about 30 years too late, right? For 40 years too late, at that point it was 2006, but it's a wonderful resource. If you ever have to speak about smoking, there's some great resources there. Okay, but put all those things on the side. If I am somebody who doesn't smoke, if the shul is a public place, what rights do I have as an individual versus somebody else? So 1981, let's go backwards to 1981. Ramosha Feinstein, whose position on smoking, it was very nuanced, very, very nuanced. So he was asked a shayla, right, by a members of a kollel. There were some guys in the kollel who wanted to smoke and some guys in the kollel who did not want to smoke. So they wrote to Ramosha asking him, do I have a right to say you can't smoke while in the kollel-based medrash? So Ramosha says, you have to understand something. We have to figure out where the problem is over here. So we have a concept in halacha called nizkei shcheinim. What is the concept of nizkei shcheinim? The concept of nizkei shcheinim is the understanding that if I live next door to you and I do something, even if it's in my own domain, right, but it causes damage to you, I have to be very careful about that. The yeshiva bachman like to learn Bava Basra. This is the second parak. Very often when the yeshiva guys learn Bava Basra, they learn the first and the third parak, and they skip the middle parak. But the middle parak is all about the Nizkei Shechinim. All the damages that we talk about, when we talk about Nizkei Shechinim, very often that in that parak, they're sort of strange, right? If I have a pit that I use to wash my clothes, and how do I wash clothes in my pit? I use caustic chemicals, right? So, you know, dry cleaning chemicals, whatever, and it seeps into the ground. Now, you're on the other side in your domain. What's going to happen if I use caustic chemicals into the water table, depending on how deep my pit is? It could seep in and get into the water in your domain. Do you then have a right to come back to me and say to me that I'm causing damage? So the Mishnayos and Bava Basra understand that, look, we have a responsibility, l'harchik nezek, I have to keep a safe enough distance in my own property that it shouldn't seep across into your property. And so the Gemara says, you know, sometimes I could be forced to fill in my pit and move over, right? Even though you moved in after me, I had the pit there first, but if I'm going to cause damage to you, we have this concept of Nizkei Shechinim, and I have to be careful. The question, however, is what is the status of this Nizkei Shechinim? Last week we were talking, not last week, 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the Arba Avos Nizikin, right? Shor, Bor, Mava, and Hever, right? So we said those are the different types of damage that are mentioned in our Torah. According to others in Bava Kama, there are 13, maybe 24, whatever it is. Where's Nizkei Shechinim? It's none of them. Does that mean that Nizkei Shechinim, the damages of the type I just described, are they midaraisa, midrabanan? No. So the truth is that we have to understand that who cares? So the answer is pretty clear. Nizkei Shechinim seems to be a din midrabanan, right? And if that's the case, then while there are some who want to argue that it's deoraisa, but there are certain leniencies, right, that would come out as a result. And why would we require the understanding of Nizkei Shechinim to be midrabanan as opposed to midaraisa? So one of the heterim is Adam Osik Besoch Shalom. If I'm doing something on my own property, on a biblical level, how could you argue that you're turning around and causing damage? The definition of Nezek means I'm invading your space. I'm doing something against you. And that's the biblical punishment for which I have to pay.
I thought that the guy at the bottom of the boat drilling the hole.
Right. So if it's my private boat and you're on the boat, then the only thing I'm chayat for is your life, right? But that would be the simple understanding. Still, notwithstanding, if you look at the Gemara in Bava Basra on Daf Chav Hey Amid Beis, there is the opinion of Rabbi Yossi who says that Nizkei Shechinim may be mutter. That's all true. But if it's gira didei, he says if it's your property that's causing direct damage, then it's still going to be usur, even according to Rabbi Yossi. In other words, even if you never leave your own property, if you damage in such a way that I make it so that from my property, now your property is not usable, it sounds like even Rabbi Yossi would say, in such a situation, this would still be forbidden. So it's like you said, drilling the hole in the boat, right? Let's say I buy I rent a space on the boat, and you rent a berth on the boat. I still don't have a right to drill a hole in the boat, in my berth. Why is that? Because I'm directly causing damage to you. Just because we're on the same cruise ship, and I rent my space, it's mine to put in a window at the bottom of the boat, right? That I don't have such a right to be able to go ahead and do so. So the Gemara in that aforementioned parak on Daf Chaf Beis Amid Beis tells this crazy story about an individual named Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef had a neighbor who had a habit of bloodletting, right? So he would bloodlet, and he would do it under his own trees, and his trees would extend over the fence. Right? So here I am, I'm the neighbor, I do bloodletting, right? I do it underneath a tree. The tree is also, it extends over to your side of the fence. What happens if you bloodlet? The blood has to go somewhere. So if I'm bloodletting on my property, where does the blood go?
On
the ground, right? Right there. And what happens? Well, it goes on the ground. And buzzards like to come in and they, when they smell blood, and what do? They would come. They come in, and they go down to go ahead and find the blood. On the way back up, they see the tree, and so they get hungry. They didn't, blood is not enough for them. They didn't find dead carcass over there, So they fly back up and they see, oh, dates. And the dates are on your side of the tree. So that's what happened in this Gemara. Rabbi Yosef, he was on the one side of the fence. He had dates growing on his side. The guy on the other side was bloodletting. The buzzards would come in and they would try to smell around and eat up the blood, right? And they would take the blood. Then they would fly up on the tree, right? Still with the blood dripping from their mouths, and they'd eat the dates. And that would leave the dates smeared with blood. Now, you're with me so far? So Rabbi Yosef had to go harvest his dates, and what was on the dates?
Blood.
And he said, ugh, right? Ugh, who wants to eat this stuff?
The dates were only there because they were coming from this tree.
Who cares? That doesn't matter. Based on the Pesach Halacha, it's my dates, right? So he wanted to argue. Rabbi Yosef said, look, the blood lawyer has to move his business. You know why? Because the dates that are on my side of the property are smeared with blood. Now, if you have dates that are smeared with blood, what can you do? Right. Still notwithstanding the fact that what? Rabbi Yosef's taina was, the fact that I find that disgusting in and of itself is reason enough for me to insist that you stop, even though what happens? I could have easily fixed my problem by washing it. Right? And this is a fundamental issue. So Moshe says, right, even though the smoker can simply have the same argument, he says, look, I'm Osik Pesok Shali. I'm smoking in my seat in the Beis Medrash. But notwithstanding, Ramosha says, your seat in the Beis Medrash is not yours. Your seat in the Beis Medrash is, as you were saying before, not because of Dina de Malchusa, because it's a public place. And you can't argue you're doing Besok Shalcha because I have a respiratory condition, or I don't like it, or I don't like the smell, right? And so when you smoke in your area, it's also affecting me. And by the way, that's even worse than the bloodletting case. Why is that? Because at least in the bloodletting case, I can argue it's my domain. This is not your domain. And so ergo what follows, right? Ramosha Paskins, that the Kol guys who are against the smoking in the Beis Medrash, right? Ramosha says, because you are smoking in the Beis Medrash, you are preventing the other guys from being able to learn in the Beis Medrash. Which means you're not allowing him to do what he needs to do in his property. And so therefore it falls into the category of Nizkei Shechenim, and therefore Moshe Paskins, that what? That one is not allowed to smoke in the public area, despite the fact that you're allowed to be there in the same way that I'm allowed to be there. The Tzitz Eliezer, both in Chelek Tezvav, Simen Lamed Tes, and in Chelek Yudzayin Simen Chaf Beis, similarly also agrees to this particular position. In fact, the Tzitz Eliezer goes one step further. He says, even if it should so happen that the guy who was the non-smoker, last month he didn't care, and now all of a sudden, the beginning of this month, he cares, still, he has a right to turn to the other guy and say, you got to stop smoking. Not in the Beis Medrash. When smoking in your car is a different story, but not in the Beis Medrash. By the way, this brings me to a second shaila. So wait, so the answer to the first shaila, do we have a right to be able to stop? The answer is yes. What if it's a minority of people who want him to stop? Again, the answer is, who cares? Even if it's one guy in the shul, right? It's a minority opinion, but if I can't go ahead and follow through, if you're interrupting me because of your smoking, so that's called Nizkei Shechenim, it's a problem, yeah.
So once upon a time, you could buy a seat on an airplane to Israel and buy in the smoking section, and it belonged to you and you had the right to smoke, even though it was a joke because it was in one big cabin.
Mm-hmm.
But people who didn't want to breathe the smoke, instead of getting a seat near the back, would make sure to buy a seat in the front.
Right.
Had to go to the back. So according to this, that's not a problem. But can we bring that forward now and say that if someone gets on a plane, they say, I'm buying my seat and I choose not to have someone of the opposite gender next to me. Why is that so different?
It's a good question. The answer is because you have an option. And what's your option? Buy the other seat. You don't have a right to step into my seat and tell me. You do have a right to purchase two seats. Let's say Dina were to decide that she did not want a man sitting next to her, right? Because that's usually the classic case that the women are always worried they don't want the man sitting next to her. Isn't that what you always read in the paper? So let's say Dina, so she would argue to you, like, no offense, but can you sit next to somebody else? Because I don't want to sit next to a man. I'm very, I, I, I was brought up in a certain way, and that's not acceptable. So the truth of the matter is that in such a situation, you have a right. You purchased the ticket. It has your name. It has your seat number. And even if you're flying Southwest, right, where they don't give you an exact seat number, but you have a right to go in on the seat and sit down where you want. If Dina wanted to do something, right, what she should have done and could have done is purchase the second seat. At that point in time, the airline has no right to force Dina to give up the empty seat next to her in order to turn around and allow you to sit next to her. Why? Because she did do the right thing in that situation. Anyone who's had to sit in a seat for, how many hours does it take to get to Los Angeles? Next to a very oversized person who's laughing and smacking the seat in front next to you as she watched the television saying, don't be doing that! Now please don't do that! And why you gotta do that? Only to find out that as she was doing it, this is the fifth time she's seen that particular episode, right? But not that I know anybody who's been in that situation, but as you're choking the whole time, you realize I could have gotten a second seat if I didn't want to get stuck in that situation.
That works there, but with smoking, you buy a seat next to you, you're still going to be affected.
By the way, al pi halacha, the other person has to stop smoking. Now, that on the airline, you know, what to do and whatever, that was a problem back then. I don't know what the answer was back then.
You used to buy a seat up front.
Right, so you...
And then walk to the back for a cigarette.
Right, so, okay, yeah. And how many people stopped you and said, please don't smoke here?
I remember it was 30 years ago.
Right, and that was the difference, yeah.
So now you have a similar situation in the shul,
mm-hmm.
where it's too hot, and they want you to put the air conditioner.
So that's that's a different issue. Why? Because I don't think you can argue that it's nizke shenim. That's a question of personal preference. It's not a question of nezek. And there's a fundamental difference. No. This is an important distinction.
It's not a
function of comfort. A function of comfort, you know, was it you showed me or was it you? Somebody showed me the sign, right? The sign in the shul, right? Say, put on a sweater, or, you know? So, the fact of the matter is that here, the difference between the two questions is, in that situation, it's a question of comfort. And in this situation, it's a question of actual nezek.
Why is it nezek? I mean, let me let you know that
if you're smoking in the room, and we'll see that that makes a big difference for the following case, but if you're smoking in the room, you're causing me nezek of secondhand smoke.
But that's not the basis of Ramosha's tshuva.
It is the basis of Ramosha's tshuva. So, in fact, Ramosha goes one step further. Let me just finish the idea while we're at it, right? If you smoke in front of me, and my lungs are damaged in the process, am I allowed to go after you and sue you for nezek? I can't do that in the situation of the air conditioner or the heat. So Ramosha says that smoking is a situation of mazik biyadayim, in which case it's not just grumma. If you created the secondhand smoke, right? You created the secondhand smoke. Therefore, you are chayv. Now, a Beis Din, I can't take you into Rabbi Jack or Rabbi Teitz, because to make such an argument, I may not be able to have them go ahead and paskin the case against you, against your will, but which Ramosha entertains, but still you'd be chayv midinei shamayim, right, in such a situation. And so therefore, it is a very distinct difference. And this is Ramosha's tshuva.
Why are we limiting it to the Beis Medrash?
Huh?
Why are we limiting it to inside the Beis Medrash?
As opposed to?
If I'm in Rishus HaRabim outside and there's an open window, it's the same effect. So they should be able to go into Rishus HaRabim and say, don't smoke over there. If the smoke is going...
So if I'm on a private property, mm-hmm. or let's say I'm on the shul property, right? And somebody is smoking by the windows of the shul property... Right, I have a right to tell him al pi halacha you're not allowed to do that. Yeah, it's 100% correct. Right?
You have the right to close the window.
It's a question of nizkei shchinim. If it's expected that the window be open. By the way, just to point out, that's why certain shuls that may or may not have rental to a bunch of kindalach, you know, to a little cheder that happens to be in its midst, that shul, you know, many shuls have a no smoking on the premises policy. Right, so that the kindalach and the cheder shouldn't be caught, you know, smoking there. That the kindalach aren't so careful about that, you know, that's an issue, and it's a question of enforcement. But wait, let me go one step further. This is where the mazik piyadayim situation happens. What does that mean, the mazik piyadayim situation happens? This is the situation where if a person is mazik piyadayim, right, the actual smoke, then I have the right. What about the other situation that which we ended the shiloh with, where the guy smells, right? He comes in and he smells like smoke. And he comes and plops himself down next to me. Now I can't listen to the Daf Yomi, right? I can't go to the Gemara. I can't learn Night Seder with my Chavrusa. I can't daven, right? So what do we do in that situation? Is the same rule apply? Can I say to him, you're being mazik me? Why not? So it's not the same thing, because here we're dealing with a situation of reyach. But so listen, there's a machaber. The machaber paskin siman ayin tes in orachayim sif aleph ha'isa toas ada me'achorav tzarech laharchik dalad amos mimalkum shakala reyach. If a guy were to have a disgusting smell, so you have to move away. You have to move away from the smell. Afilum yeshlo choli she'ena mariach. Right? Even if that guy can't smell, he still has to move 4 amos away from something that if you could smell, you'd have to leave.
So based on
the
reach or based on
soa?
The quote from the
Maharaj. Very good. So David jumps up and he makes a very fascinating distinction, right? And so, sure enough, you and the Chafetz Chaim, you know, and it's pretty good company to be in. So the Chafetz Chaim in Siman Ayin Tes of Katan Chaf Gimel, he says, what does it mean, Reach? So he defines Reach Ra, Hainu Kol Shederech B'nei Adam Letztar Me'oso Areach. If it's a situation where normal people normally care about that smell. And Kosov Achai Adam, Rav Avram Danziger explains, Davar Shetivo Reach Ra, it has to be something that by nature causes a Reach Ra, going Itron V'chadome Mutter, right? Even if it has a naphtha smell, right? You know, you still don't have to move away from it. What's the only time, V'lo Nikri Tzoa? When do you have to move away? When it's tzoa. What's tzoa? Excrement. When's it called excrement? Elamasha nisrach machmas ipush. If it's something that is smelly because it is decaying, right? So in such a situation, then you have to move away. So that's one. And two, when you're dealing with a regular person, it's not the person that smells. It's the clothing that smells. A smell on a person, there's a lot more room to daven next to the person. The Be'er Mayim Chaim, the son of Rav Chaim Vital, he brings down from the, I'm sorry, he is quoted by the Shaul Shetshuva Shevet HaKasi Chelek Dalet Siman Lamed Zayin, right, who says that if a person has a bad smell because he never has a problem with his, tract, right, whereby he's leaking all the time, right? And so in such a situation, then you can't have it next to the person, right? But even though we care about kavanah brios, that's only for a particular moment, not each and every day. So if the guy next to you, every single day, he can't change his underwear smells like urine, then you would have a problem. But if a person has smoke on his clothing, that's the source for that is not called ipush. And so therefore, what happens? You can't force him to leave. The only Shaila that's left is, what about you? Do you have to leave? Huh? Now do you hear that? Because why?
Because it's disgusting.
So the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Tzadi Chesed Beis points out, lo yispala b'mok m'sheish davash m'vat al kavanaso. A person's not allowed to daven in a place where he has no kavana.
So if there are people talking in your bench, you have to leave shul?
So maybe you have to move away, based on that comment, you would have to move away from that location. Go sit next to the rabbi, right? Assuming the rabbi's not talking, right? The Mishnah Berurah, though. Wait. What? 1 second. The Mishnah Berurah in Siman Tzadi Ches of Katan Zion does point out, he says, you do have to remember, we don't have kavana, remember? We kept pointing that out. Our kavana today, remember the OCD share, our kavana is not really kavana. Does that apply here? Says the Mishnah Berurah, wait, 1 thing. We don't just simply toss it out the kavana out the window. Maybe we don't have the greatest kavana, but if you have something that's totally taking you away, right, you don't have an ability. So in summation to question number one, which Marvin asked me, to start with, yes, a shul can enact a policy on smoking, even if it affects but one person negatively, because the issue is nizkei shcheinim. But if a person is unable to concentrate because of the smell on the other guy's clothing, so in such a situation, he certainly can't force the other guy to leave. Maybe what he should do is find a different spot. So as I'm discussing the Shia with somebody in our minyan, so he says to me, Hitaka has that problem. I said, I'm sorry, I try to change my clothes every day. He doesn't dive near me. It's not Marvin and it's not Josh. So he says, when it's a problem, what he does is he tries to quietly and politely move to another location. But he says it affects him. What can he do? And so he said to me, Al Pi Halacha, what are you going to come out with? I said, it's your problem. That's what the deal is, Al Pi Halacha. Yeah.
What about someone who's very allergic to women's perfume? So that's an allergy. We're not talking about just discomfort, so that would be considered mezek, so they just tell every woman around them you're not allowed to.
I think the question is, first of all, right, so the question is what is normal to be expected from the tzibur and what's not. We have a right to declare it, so we're not obligated to declare it. So if the other person has a place to daven, if the other person, let's say the person is has another place to daven, then we don't have a right. Whether we should do it anyway for a kavod abrias to invite somebody else inside is a different story. And certainly there are, those instances do come up. And there,
is this like peanuts? We would say, technically speaking,
if the shul did not want to enact a policy, can a single individual force us to enact a policy? So if the person were to be a member in such a situation, that theoretically, yes. Right, but if the person would have a, and there you're dealing with an airborne allergy, so it's not like I could say to you, Dom, in this room, that room, this side, that side, right? The question about the perfume, I don't know. I have to find out. I don't think so. I think that we can find another space for the person to daven comfortably. I don't think we can force everybody else. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, right? There's a question of kavod abrias, but to force it, I think, would be a different question.
Is there precedent for this, that the tanners used to have their own shul?
So I looked into it, right? The Bursiki, I tried to remember where it was. Yeah, but there was no enactment. The deal had to do with being about allowing them to duchen, because we would be so moved, we'd wind up concentrating on them. That's what you do remember. But my head went to the same place you did when I was researching, right? Okay, who wanted me? You wanted me to deal with the measles. So the big story came out that in the Mir Yeshiva, eight different bachurim came down with the measles this week, right? And this is already after what I told you I heard on the news. And, this Shiloh's got some very, very...
vaccinated?
So the answer is, I don't know what the story is, who was vaxxed and who wasn't. But I can tell you this much, that there's some great history. In order for me to get to the Shiloh I want to deal with, I have to point out that may not make a difference, right? Just medically, it may not make a difference. You'll see in a second. In the end of the 18th century, there was a very major disease called smallpox, okay? And of course, as was well known, it was a rampant disease. Millions of people died. And there was a crude vaccination that was suggested at the time. And what was the vaccination? Inject some of the disease into healthy people. A lot of people said, wow, that's crazy. We've never heard of such a thing, and it was counterintuitive. What do you mean? You're going to stick the very disease into the person? Now, others would say, sure, we do this all the time. It's cognitive behavioral therapy, but only with biology, right? The Ramban had previously written in Torah Sa'adam, he says, look, the Torah gives us a right because of the famous rule of Virapo, Yirape, that the Torah gives the right to engage in medicine. Medicine by nature is unpredictable, and so something that could be therapeutic to one person could be deadly to another person. You'd think that maybe you should avoid treatments. Therefore, the Torah says that what do we do? We trust the medical distinction. We look at the modern medical times. This is very similar to that thought that you and I were talking about last night when it came to Avraham and Yitzchak, what I quoted to you from my great Rebbe. Going back to the late 18th century, so the Tiferes Yisrael in Masechta Yuma, Perek Ches, Os Gimel, so he says, nearly heter lasos inoculation. And here you find that great word inoculation, which is a fancy word for vaccination, which is also a fancy word. And basically, when he says that if even though there's a small chance that you can contract the disease and die from the injection, there's a greater risk of dying by not having the injection. And so therefore he says it's permissible. This is in the late 18th century, right? Before we've improved the vaccinations, to say that what? You're not obligated, but you are permitted to take such a risk. And also in the 18th century, there was an individual who lost two kids to smallpox. His name was Rab Avram ben Shlomo, and he wrote a sefer called Alei Tufa. And in that sefer, he begged the Jews of his time, please, please use vaccines. Right? And he says in the Sephardic communities, it was already commonplace to take blood from an infected individual and inject it into healthy individuals. Why should one have vaccinations? The argument has been advanced that it's a shayla v'nishmatim ol d'nashu seichem, right? And the Rambam, in two places, there's a very big discussion as to whether this is a mitzvah sasei or a mitzvah slo sasei. There are a lot of side topics that come out of it, but that is the basis for the argument that you have a responsibility in terms of, and it may be v'rapo yirapei, it may be that even taking preventative steps is part of this idea of v'nishmartem. That previously discussed issue, because the Rambam identifies it both as an asay and a los asay, we have to try to figure out how could it be both an asay and a los asay. So the Marcheshes, among others who deals with this question, the Marcheshes is of course the final Rav of Warsaw, right? So he brings down that there are two different issues. One is, if you have an opportunity to avoid a hazard, that may be an assay. If you have an opportunity to avoid a hazard, that's a mitzvah slos assay not to do it, right? And if you can eliminate a hazard, then it's a mitzvah assay, right? If I don't avoid it, I'm chayev. But if I have an ability to eliminate it from this world, then Vinishmartam says that I have to go out of the way. That's the Marcheshes' understanding. And why should people not vax?
It's a lack of bitachon.
So that is, believe it or not, a basis of an argument. It's called Shomer Pesoim Hashem, right? That God protects the fools. Right? So Shomer Pesoim Hashem, which is the argument, one of the arguments. So Rav Ovadia Yosef comes along in the Tshuvan Yabia Omer Yoredeya Chela Gimel Simon Zion, where Rav Ovadia says Shomer Pesoim Hashem only applies where you have to go do a mitzvah. There's a challenge, so you want to go do the mitzvah anyway, and you're worried about a potential sakana. Then the Rav Ovadia says you have a right to go ahead and say Shomer Pesoim Hashem. That means you can weigh the risk against the benefit. Mori V'Rabbi Rav Shachter writes in Be'ikvei Atzon Simen Lamedal, he says, no, Shomer Pesoim Hashem applies in situations where it's not a significant risk. But if it's a significant risk, then you don't have a right to say God protects the fools. If you're that foolish, then even God can't protect you. You're not allowed to go play in traffic and say Shomer Pesoim Hashem. You just can't do that. Right? So this is.
People can point out, look, there are millions of people who don't vaccinate, and 30 people got the measles. So what's your chance?
So Rabbi Bleich, Rav Yehuda Leib Bleich, was also one of my Rebbeim, and wrote in Contemporary Halachic Problems, Volume Number 7. He says a person cannot make the assumption Shomer Pesoim Hashem on behalf of everyone else. So when you choose not to vax, what right do you have to do that for me? Moreover, what right do you have to do it for your own kid? So that's on the basis of that. So and my dear friend, our dear friend, Rav Ari Leibowitz, also happens to add that that aforementioned tshuva, the one about Rav Moshe and the smoking, he says Shomer Pesoim Hashem applies if the shmira is based on a personal hanhaga, right? But this is not a question of personal hanhaga. This is about what everybody does. You don't have a right to go ahead and go in that direction. So all of that is, all of those arguments go out the window. So why do people not vax? The answer has nothing to do with halacha. The answer, well, not overtly. The answer can be found in a medical journal called The Lancet. 1998, The Lancet published a landmark study, 12 authors, and suggesting that there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Right.
I was proven wrong.
Yeah, so that's a so
this,
what? Ah, very good. So subsequent studies that between 98, 99, and 2000 proved first the original article was based on fraudulent research, which led 10 of the 12 original authors to retract. Then it led, subsequent research led the primary author on the article to lose his medical license, right? And then it sounded like he was interested in financial gain, and that's why he slanted the article. And that led The Lancet itself to actually retract the entire article. This is one of the number one medical journals. What's the primary medical journal of England, if I'm not mistaken, The Lancet, right? So based on all of this, right, the whole anti-vaxxer movement, at least in, for the most part in the firm community, is walking around based on an article that is not only fraudulent, but it doesn't exist. Now, based on Ramosha, Igros Moshe Eben Ezer, Chelek Dalid, Simon Yud, based on his argument that not to be tested for Tesax in today's time doesn't allow you to argue Shomer Pesayim Hashem because the solution is readily available, the same argument should apply over here as well. And this leads, at least as quoted by Moriv Rabbi, Rabbi Bleich, page 465 in the 7th volume of Contemporary Halachic Problems, Rav Yashiv Zatzal supposedly says, if you don't vax your children, you are a poshea. What is a poshea? Pshia. Pshia, what's pshia?
Negligence.
Yeah, this is not, we were talking about Nezek Midr Rabbanan before, Nizkei Shechenim. This is pshia deraisa, right? You are a poshea. You're not only a poshea against your own kids, you are a poshea, theoretically, against the entire community. There is one exception, says Rabbi Bleich. And what is that? There is a certain type of immunity that is recognized called herd immunity. My dear Dr. Moradi, what is herd immunity?
Herd immunity is basically you get vaccinated not because of the risk of developing the disease, but rather because it prevents others from contracting the disease from you.
Which, nafkamina being? If everybody else vaxes and I don't vax, theoretically speaking, I should be fine.
Scientifically, you will be fine.
Right. So the question is, okay, so why can't I apply the same thing over here? So Rabbi Bleich says, first of all, I know people who taka have this problem, you know, they're allergic to the MMR vaccine. There are people in the world like that, right? They're the ones who need the benefit of herd immunity. When you take your information based on the this growing movement, right, you are ruining herd immunity because the larger the group of people who don't vax, the more likely, think about it, if I have 100 people and one doesn't vax, and the all other 99 vax, then the one person is safe, right? But if now 12 of the 100 people don't vax, now that person's not safe anymore, right? So the herd immunity argument doesn't exactly work over here, right? Just agav urcha, don't come back to me with herd immunity. So all of this under discussion, we now understand why the vaxxers are pretty upset with the anti-vaxxers. Here's the question. Can a community force vaccination? So there's a tosis in Psachim. Tosis in Psachim appears on Daf. Mem Vav Amid Beis, Tosis Debi Amasko Rabba Omar, where Tosis makes the following statement. Let's say this is like the strangest place to find this Tosis and apply it. We know that there's a concept called Bishul. As far as Shabbos is concerned, can a person be Mevashel B'Shabbos? In what instance can a person be Mevashel B'Shabbos? Right? Any chola? A chola sheyesh bo sakana. Why can't I cook every Shabbos on the basis of the fact that someone may come to the door and be a chola sheyesh bo sakana? Why can't I do that?
It's not common.
Huh? Yeah? So because and that's exactly, Tosa says, Chola sheyesh bo sakana is an uncommon situation. And the answer is that the possibility of using the food for a chola sheyesh bo sakana is so remote that we don't have the ability to categorize it as pikuach nefesh to allow us to cook all the way through, right? And this has a lot of ramifications for other issues concerning pikuach nefesh, right? But there is a nafkamina for vaxing in the following way, right? Can one vax on Shabbos?
Can one what?
Can I give vaccines to my kids on Shabbos? Now, what's the problem with giving vaccines?
You may bleed. I mean, it's also refuah.
It's not refuah.
It's refuah.
You have to be refuah if you're not sick.
You're doing something that has theoretical.
So once upon a time, there was a once upon a time in Europe, this was a very major issue because doctors doctors only came to town once a yovel. Right? And if the day the doctor came to your town with Shabbos and you didn't take the kids to be vaxxed, right, your kid wouldn't get the vaccine till the next time the doctor came around, which could be a year and a half from now, assuming the kid was still there. Right? So the shaila was brought up in Europe and it was a very major issue. So nowadays that's a little bit less of an issue, but Rosh Shlomo Zalman said, look, it has the following situation, right? Yeah, but the question is, can I bring my kids? Right? And what if the doctor who's traveling happens to be Jewish? No. So the answer is, what if the people are going to panic? Right? Forget about the fact that it's so remote that in the, you know, to nowadays, right? So if a child, when is the first dosage given? 2 weeks or a month? Or what? You remember?
For MMR?
For, yeah.
6 months.
6 months, right? So what if the child turns 6 months? Child turns 6 months on Shabbos. And if you wait till Sunday, Monday, what's the big deal? No big deal. But in shul, you want to bring the kid to shul because you're going to make, let's say it's a girl, right? You're going to make the kiddush, right? So everyone's like, what? No, you can't bring non-vax kids into the shul. Oh my gosh. Can you bring the kid to shul? Can you bring the kid to the doctor to get the kid vaxxed on Shabbos? So technically speaking, it says Rosh Shlomo Zalman, today people don't freak out like that. A day or two people are like, forget about it. It's not a very major issue. But if you were to be in a situation where the entire community does freak out, or you'd have to wait 4 or 5 years, like in Europe, till the doctor came around, vax the kids on Shabbos, right? And categorizing, what do we see based on this? Categorizing a threat level is a public concern does come into the factor. If the population gets nervous about people dying, so then that should be treated to a certain degree, potentially, as a pikuach nefesh.
Or would it depend on the illness that you're vaccinating for?
What do you mean, flu versus
chickenpox, right? It can be deadly in like 1% of
depends,
cases. But
depends how crazy the community is. So, you know, it does. It does make a difference.
What if it's based on
the flu?
Poor science.
Huh?
What if they're...
it's the whole community is wrong. Really, having no vaccinated kids is not a big deal.
On Friday,
right?
The MMR takes absolutely no effect.
Yeah, so that this does have certain ramifications. My question is the opposite of your question. I hear your question, but my question is the opposite, right? My question is, can the fact that the community is freaking itself out, can that come into play over here? And the way we paskin the halacha is, quite honestly, we do see that if it's based on something and the community is going to go absolutely bunkaroos, right, then you do. And therefore, if a school were to have such a policy that we don't allow children who don't have vaccines because the parents would go crazy, the answer is the school does have a right. It would therefore ergo follow that if a shul were to enact a similar policy, right, then, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. We're excluding people from shuls. What's the word?
Disenfranchised.
Yeah, but you know what? Because of the situation, this is something that has to happen. I need to point this out because I've been asked to. This is not just something that Litvisher Gedolim talk about. This is something that appears. The late, great, and I'll say this even though Yudi's not here to hear me because he likes it when I say it this way, the late, great Lubavitcher Rebbe Zechusa Yagen Aleinu Zatzal, in Igros Kodesh Chelek Yud Aleph on page 137, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, in regard to your query regarding my opinion on vaccinations that are commonly given to young children, with regard to these matters, the Gemara's opinion of Al Tifrosh Minat Tzibur, or don't separate from yourself from the community, it applies. And so therefore you should act according to that which is practiced by the majority of children who are in your children's class. So not to vex, even if you are in the Hasidic community, is a very big shaila. Rabbi Neuwirth, the author of the Shemir Shabbos Kehilchasa, he was quoted as saying that he was strongly in favor of vaccinating, and he wanted to encourage parents to make the choice because the risk of danger, because of the risk of danger, but he felt that that risk was so low that we couldn't compel those who didn't want to vaccinate to do so. But Rav Yosha strongly disagreed with that, as we mentioned before. Listen to his language. Bimrov ha'yiladim bakita mechusanim mimnei nigof kol shehu v'yeshnam yiladim yechidim sha'orim shalahem lo chisnu osam. There are certain individual parents who did not vaccinate. U'bakita yesh horim ha'choshishim mikach. And in the class, there are parents who are upset. They're worried about that. Yecholim ha'horim l'drosh me'ayechidim l'nhog keklal. Right? And so Rav Yashiv turned around and took the position, not to vax makes you a masik, and you can be removed from the class. Ergo, let's head back to a wonderful city in southern New Jersey that had such a shaila. I think it was in 2003 or 2007. I forget which one. Rav Asher Bush has an article in Chakira Volume 13, if I'm not mistaken, where he puts in both letters. First, in the first letter, there was a Beis Din in Lakewood that argued that whether to accept children who are not immunized. They researched the issue, and the Beis Din passed in the following 4 points. One, every parent is obligated to immunize the children in order to prevent serious illness, chas v'shalom, both to the child as well as to the tzibur. Two, the school should enforce the policy as required by law and should insist on immunization records. Three, if an individual, based on his doctor and or Rav's advice, should choose not to immunize his child, the school may accept the child without requiring his immunization. And they said at the time, it is in fact recommended they do so. Subsequently, all three Dayanim have retracted this last statement. Number four, in a case where the school feels that it will be negatively affected by such a policy, whether it's threats of a lawsuit or fines or parental pressure, the school has the right not to accept the children, and shaila should be referred to the Beis Din, and all has to be done with Dina D'Malchusa. That was the first Beis Din. There was a letter that was issued by some of the leaders in Lakewood who put out a second letter. In light of the recent mumps outbreak in our community, and in light of the assistance of some school pediatricians, that until the end of the outbreak, children who have not received the MMR vaccine should not be accepted into school. They stated, as Shomri Torah Mitzvos, Menalim must understand that taking position on a medical situation, denying a child acceptance to school, or forcing someone to vaccinate his children against his will, are all decisions involving serious halachic shilas. Vaccination processes involve risks recognized by the medical establishment. Consequently, each individual has the right to his opinion and choice in the matter. And no one has the power to force someone to vaccinate his children against his will. And three, after considering the nature of the current outbreak, the very high percentage of fully vaccinating individuals among the mumps cases, the serious risks associated with the MMR vaccine, and the halachic gravity of denying a child acceptance, even for one day, it's our opinion that unless truly obligated to do so, no school has the right to deny a child acceptance. May the schools of conducting ourselves according to Das Torah be a true protection. Wow! This second Beis Din turned around and said the first Beis Din is wrong. Well, folks, now look at what happened as a result. Now we have shuls all over Lakewood telling people, you can't forget about coming to yeshivas. You can't do this at all. In a weird twist of irony, January 31st, 2018, a booklet appeared in Pittsburgh. Yes, the Pittsburgh Jewish Community, an organization, anonymous organization calling itself PEACH, and they issued something called the Vaccine Safety Handbook, which was sent around to homeowners in the community. And in it was 40 pages of why you should not vax your children, right? And Nina Butler, who is a very major askanit in the community there, so she put it out, and she posted the following on her social media page. As a mother of a child who has died, I knew the her child who died, Mikey, Olava Shalom, is related to Rabbi Blasher, and two children who have autism. I would never be so perversely evil as to endanger other people's children with baseless scare tactics, factual distortions, and outright lies. What's worse, these nameless cowards produced under the pretense of Jewish authority this booklet. Nauseating. Right? She said the motivation was pathetic. The fact of the matter is, Rabbi Leibowitz, when I spoke to him about the issue, so he pointed out, there's a Gemara in Bava Kama, I'm sorry, in Bava Basra, where the Gemara says that if you don't fix roads and you leave a michshol in the middle of the world of the road, then you can be in violation of something called v'haya alecha damin, that the blood is going to be on your hands. The same thing applies to schools and shuls. If you don't vax your children and you bring them into these public areas, you run the risk of having v'haya alecha damin. Rabbi Yashiv says you are a posheya. So three, four weeks ago, we were sitting with Rav Asher, and when we discussed the issue with Rav Asher, we asked him, is it mutter? We didn't know about this whole crisis. And so he said, schools and shuls, and this is a quote I have based on my notes, they do have the right. And said Rav Asher, I think that they should exercise that right. There is a chiyuv of the yachid towards the community to vaccinate. A person is not permitted to do something that is going to be nezek to somebody else, even if that potential for nezek is pachus mishava pruta. When I went to discuss the issue with Moreinu v'Rabbeinu this morning, Rabbi Teitz's response to me was the same thing. And he says, you'll see later today that no one less than Rav Zilberstein Shalita is going to come out and say that. It is also the view of Moreinu Harav Teitz as well. And so therefore, the policy and the answer to our question is as follows. Does a shul have a right to enact a policy, even if my psak halacha is against the psak halacha of the shul? You know what we say? Too bad. Your psak halacha is wrong. But in this shul, or in these schools, or in this situation, the community has the right to argue that we have to protect ourselves. And if that is indeed the case, the individual has a responsibility to follow through. Okay? We've covered 2 out of 3. We'll have to save Ot Chazon Lamoed on the third one as well. Okay, we'll stop here, Bezes Hashem, and we'll continue.